Well, there you are. You're sitting there thinking, well, this is it. This is it. Here we go.
Five people swim to shore after their plane crashes into the waters near Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, August 14th. Good evening. I'm Rachel Waldholz. Also tonight, amidst deepening divisions, residents in Haines are heading to the polls.
A recall is a gun held to the head of an elected leader.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
After violence broke out in Charlottesville, Virginia, both of Alaska's U.S. senators have condemned this weekend's Unite the Right demonstrations. Senator Dan Sullivan issued a strongly worded statement that singled out the alt-right and their allies, writing, quote, "The sight of white supremacists and neo-Nazis marching in an American city is a disgrace." Sullivan also said he welcomes news that the U.S. Justice Department is investigating what he and Attorney General Jeff Sessions describe as an act of domestic terrorism. Hundreds of Facebook users added their own comments to his post. Some thanked Sullivan for specifically calling out far-right groups, but quite a few commenters defended the white supremacists or claimed Sullivan should have allotted equal blame to counter-protesters on the left. Of 100 comments that appeared on Sullivan's post, just over half criticized the senator for condemning only the neo-Nazi side. Nearly all of the comments appear to have come from Alaskans. Senator Lisa Murkowski also weighed in on Facebook on Sunday, saying, quote, "Hatred, racism, anti-Semitism, and bigotry are not welcome in America and will not be condoned." She said she was appalled by the news coming out of Charlottesville. Murkowski did not specifically name-check the alt-right or neo-Nazis. Comments on her post were more mixed. A plane on its way from Skagway to Juneau made an emergency water landing this morning. Everyone on board the aircraft swam safely to shore. KHNS's Abby Collins spoke with one of the survivors and has this report.
Well, there you are. You're sitting there thinking, well, this is it. This is it. Here we go.
Haines resident Luck Dunbar boarded the Alaska Seaplanes flight around 5:30 a.m. Monday. The plane flew from Haines to Skagway to pick up three more passengers. Then it headed to Juneau. Dunbar is a commercial fisherman who was on his way to Sitka to get his boat. Once on board the flight, he took a nap. He woke up to what he describes as the engine making an unusual noise. Soon after, he says the plane started to descend early. He asked the pilot what was going on.
Pointed over by Cogland Island and said, I think we're going to layer down over here.
According to the Alaska State Troopers, the pilot was Haines resident Joshua Poirier. Poirier declared an emergency following an engine failure. That's according to a press release from Seaplanes General Manager Carl Ramseth. The troopers say Poirier made an emergency landing in the ocean, about 150 feet from Cogland Island. Dunbar says after hitting the water, they were able to keep the plane upright.
Josh, the pilot, did an amazing job. He kept the nose up, and we hit the water as slow as that plane could fly, and still keeping the nose up. And by the time the nose hit, we had lost enough momentum where we didn't flip the plane.
Then they exited the aircraft.
I opened the door without a problem, opened it up wide, reached down to unbuckle, and I had water going up my arm pretty quick, and got unbuckled. And I look back, everybody's scrambling, doing their thing to get out of the plane. The back door opened, the pilot opened his door, I opened my door, everybody scrambled, got out of the plane.
All four passengers and Poirier swam to shore.
We swam and swam and swam. I'm not going to lie, by the time I got to the beach, I was pretty exhausted. I had too many layers on and I was feeling pretty heavy, and I was feeling pretty blessed to just relax and have my feet touch the sand of the beach of Cogland Island.
According to the troopers, an Alaska Seaplanes aircraft equipped with floats responded to the scene and retrieved the four passengers. Poirier stayed on the beach and was later picked up by coastal helicopters. All of the passengers and the pilot were assessed by Capital City Fire Rescue and were released with no injuries. Troopers say the plane that went down was a Cessna T207 on wheels. Its last airworthiness certificate was issued by the FAA in September of 2015. It's set to expire in about a year. The National Transportation Safety Board and Alaska Seaplanes are working together to determine the cause of the accident. RAMSIF commended Poirier's actions in the incident. Dunbar thanked the airline and credits Poirier with the success of the rescue.
He did an amazing job. He instructed us on exactly what to do at the proper time, and we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Josh.
Alaska Seaplanes is based in Juneau and operates daily flights to communities in Southeast Alaska. Seaplanes gained a monopoly on its market after competitor Wings of Alaska shut down in March. Dunbar says this incident has not deterred him from flying.
I'll be flying happily for the rest of my life, knowing that can't happen twice, right?
In fact, he got on another seaplane's flight to finish his trip to Sitka the same day. In Haines, I'm Abby Collins.
The state's largest newspaper is filing for bankruptcy protection and may soon have new owners. The Alaska Dispatch News announced a deal this weekend that could turn the paper over to a publishing group made up of lifelong Alaskans. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes has more.
In an article on its front page Sunday, the Dispatch reported that its owner, Alice Rogoff, is stepping down, and new owners are taking control immediately. The new owners are a group of siblings led by Fairbanks businessman Ryan Binkley, along with Jason Evans, originally of Nome. Evans currently owns three small Alaska papers, including the Arctic Sounder, Bristol Bay Times, Dutch Harbor Fisherman, and Homer Tribune. In a statement, the new owners say they're committed to keeping up the paper's robust coverage of Anchorage and the state. The deal is not final. Evans wrote an email to staff at his papers Monday saying the new arrangement could fall apart due to uncertainty of the bankruptcy process. Evans added that it's the Binkley family that is seeking to buy the paper out of bankruptcy, and his main contribution is advice. That includes pushing the paper to hire Jerry Grilley, a former publisher of the Anchorage Daily News and Denver Post, whom Evans describes as a newspaper turnaround expert. The ADN is facing multiple lawsuits over allegations of unpaid bills and breached contracts. On Friday, telecom firm GCI filed a complaint seeking to recoup nearly $3 million and evict ADN from the warehouse space that houses the paper's printing press. In a statement published by the Dispatch, Rogoff says it's a bittersweet moment to be handing off stewardship of the paper, adding that financial realities can't be wished away. Rogoff bought the paper for $34 million in 2014. Neither Rogoff nor the new owners offered any information on the fate of the Dispatch's current employees or whether the company expects to downsize in the immediate future. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Voters in Haines will decide whether to recall half of their borough assembly tomorrow. Three assembly members are accused of misconduct in office. But as KHNS's Emily Files reports, the discontent driving the recall is about much more than the official charges. And the recall leaders have repeatedly refused to defend their views on the record.
I'm an obituary writer, and I feel as if there's been a death in my family. And the grief is going to stay with me.
That's Assemblymember Heather Lendy talking about the personal toll of the recall. She, Tom Morfitt, and Tresham Gregg are the targets of this recall election. Here's Morfitt.
Politics in Haines has always been a very rough game.
Morfitt is speaking here during a public forum organized by Haines Media. Lendy and Gregg also took part, but more than 30 recall sponsors or supporters declined to participate. In fact, the recall's main sponsor, Don Turner Jr., has not agreed to any on-tape interviews with KHNS or on-the-record interviews with the newspaper. Instead, he and other recall leaders have used Facebook, newspaper advertisements, and a 10-page mailer to share their views. The only recall sponsor who talked to KHNS on tape is Ryan Cook. In a June interview, he said he and others started looking into a recall almost as soon as Morfitt and Lendy took office last October. Cook was a losing candidate in that race.
This town's always been split on lots of different issues, but since this assembly has been in, you've never seen it so split like this before.
Cook and Turner handed in recall petitions in April. They included several charges against the assembly members. Two of those charges made it past the borough attorney. The attorney emphasized that a recall is a political, not legal process. He did not investigate the charges, but said two of them, if assumed to be true, would constitute misconduct in office. One is an alleged violation of the Alaska Open Meetings Act by all three assembly members. The accusation is based on an email in which Greg asks for Lendy's support on an upcoming vote. He writes that two other assembly members, Morfitt and Ron Jackson, are on the same page. This could imply that Greg participated in serial polling or serial meetings, a gray area in open meetings law. Here's Greg at the public forum.
I don't think that one little email that asked for some support is really an offense worthy of recall.
The second allegation is that Morfitt and Lendy coerced a subordinate for personal or financial gain. It stems from a debate over the Haines police blotter. The police chief, Heath Scott, stopped releasing the blotter to the newspaper, which Morfitt owned at the time and Lendy writes obituaries for. Both Morfitt and Lendy spoke out in support of the blotter being made public again. The two assembly members say calling that coercion of the police chief is absurd.
It strikes me as strange that, you know, a grandmother of six somehow has brought the Haines Police Department to its knees over the police blotter.
Recall supporters maintain that the assembly members abused their power in these two cases. But the effort to oust them is about more than the grounds listed on the petitions. The evidence of this is in the ads and flyer recall leader Turner has put out. He accuses the assembly members of yelling at borough employees and going against 75% of the people in their decisions. He also points to the assembly firing a previous borough manager and hiring the current manager as, quote, good reasons for recall.
A recall is a gun held to the head of an elected leader.
That's Morfitt responding to a question about people voting for the recall for reasons not listed on the ballot.
I ask that people honor the intent of the system and consider the recall only on the grounds on which it was brought.
If early voting is an indication, public interest in the recall election is strong. Borough manager Deborah Schnabel says early voting has been unprecedented, with more than 30 ballots cast on some days. If the recall is successful and all three assembly members lose their seats, Haines will be voting for its entire six-person assembly in October. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, 75 years after forced evacuation and internment, an apology on St. George Island.
When you're treated the way we were treated, it never wears off.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This month, the oil and gas company Bluecrest Energy announced they are pausing their drilling operation in Cook Inlet. The company says the state owes it nearly $100 million in unpaid tax credits. They're the latest independent producer to pull back operations in Alaska, citing a cash for credit scheme that the state no longer supports. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
Alaska owes nearly $1 billion to some of its newest oil and gas development companies. And that tab comes from a cashable credits program that was intended to entice smaller, independent companies to explore new fields and hopefully develop them into producing oil and gas. But when oil prices crashed, first the governor and then the legislature said that the state could no longer afford the program. So in this year's marathon budget negotiations, it got cut. And as for the companies waiting to get reimbursed for cash credits they've already earned, the state's making its minimum payments. So they're going to be waiting for a while. Larry Persily is the chief of staff for the Kenai Peninsula Borough and a longtime oil and gas industry analyst. He says the state essentially left a Dear John letter to its small and independent companies.
Gee, I'm sorry. We can't pay you. I understand you can't keep working if you don't get paid. Hopefully we can figure this out soon. Let's keep in touch.
Blue Crest Energy is the latest of these smaller companies to fall victim to the defunct cashable credits program. It announced on August 1st that it couldn't afford to drill any new wells on the Kenai Peninsula and that it would be laying off about 150 people. The Texas-based company has been developing the Cosmopolitan field in Cook Inlet since 2012. Its founder and CEO, Benji Johnson, says he initially chose to do business in Alaska in part because the state's tax regime was friendly and offered an irresistible lure in the form of cash.
Now, what those credits were was basically a co-investment with the independent companies.
And with the state as an investment partner of sorts, Johnson says Blue Crest calculated that it could spend about $500 million to drill several wells and start producing thousands of barrels of oil a day. They raised $400 million of that, and Johnson says they expected to earn the other $125 million in cash rebates from the state. But as of now, they've only received a fraction of that from the state, and they spent all the money they raised. The company is only producing about 200 barrels of oil a day, not nearly enough to cover its operating costs, much less pay for new drilling. Johnson says the company will finish the two wells it's currently working on, and those should start producing sometime in September. But after that?
We can't continue spending the enormous amounts to drill new wells right now.
Johnson says Blue Crest is actively seeking out investors to raise the money it needs to keep drilling. But while it waits, the slowdown is resonating in other parts of the economy. Jimmy Doyle is the vice president of Weaver Brothers Trucking. He says Blue Crest's decision to stop drilling is a kick to the already struggling oil and gas economy on the Kenai Peninsula. When business is booming, the company's Cornflower Blue rigs haul everything from oilfield construction equipment to petroleum products to asphalt throughout the interior and south central Alaska. But when oil prices fell and the economy contracted, Weaver Brothers had to let a few people go to help cope with the loss of business.
And you guys haven't really recovered from that impact?
No, not to as busy as we were from 2012 through 2014 as far as having the amount of manpower dedicated to that piece of the business. We haven't recovered.
And the layoffs will have a ripple effect.
One company hires two or three or four or five or 10 or 20 or 30 people, and then that causes other businesses to hire people to supply them. So the trickle-down effect is huge, and especially in a time when other companies are already pulling in their horns a little bit.
Doyle understands the argument that the state can't afford to pay subsidies to oil companies like it did in the past. But he doesn't think that program or others like it are going to substantially change the state's economy. He says that all depends on the price of oil. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Seventy-five years after supervising the Onungan internment during World War II, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has finally apologized to the people of St. George Island. When federal officials visited the island last month to make amends in person, KUCB's Laura Craigle was there.
Before a small crowd at the St. George Community Center, Wes Kuhn says Fish and Wildlife is ready to take responsibility for its actions.
And I'm here to deliver the long overdue apology for the tragedies that befell the Aleut people on our watch.
Kuhn's is acting captain of a research vessel owned by Fish and Wildlife. In 1942, the agency removed St. George Islanders from their homes and sent them to internment camps following the Japanese attack on Dutch Harbor. Almost 50 of the evacuees died from sickness and starvation.
To the Aleut people interned at Hunter Bay and their descendants who continue to carry this burden, I'm sorry.
Here to receive the apology is a 78-year-old survivor.
My name is Anthony Merkulyev, born here on St. George.
Merkulyev was sent to Funter Bay as a toddler, so he doesn't remember details from the three-year internment. But he says the experience has stayed with him.
It has an effect on you when you're treated the way we were treated. It never wears off.
Still, Merkulyev says he accepts the apology. To him, the most important thing is to continue healing and keep this history alive.
The suffering that we went through, how many people we died because of the poor conditions. Hopefully it'll never be repeated.
That's why Merkulyev is glad his grandniece is at the apology ceremony. Leah Lakanoff is 15, and she says the commemoration has motivated her to learn more about what her family and her people endured.
When I get home, I was going to ask my grandma about it more, and my uncle, obviously.
For now, though, Lakanoff says she's happy to watch her great-uncle Anthony as he receives an official letter of apology from Fish and Wildlife.
I saw him smile so hard that I haven't seen in a long time. I was just so happy to see him smile.
In St. George, I'm Laura Craigle.
The decade-long project to move the village of Newtok in the Yukon Delta is finally beginning to take shape. KYUK's Christine Trudeau was at the new village for the ribbon cutting last week. The new site is safely above the water that threatens Newtok.
One, two, three, go!
A small group of Newtok residents is gathered high up on the bluffs at the new site of the village in Maktagavik.
It's a safe land, it's high, it's beautiful.
Lifelong Newtok resident Albertina Charles is thrilled to be here. Located a 10 to 15 minute walk from the newly extended boat harbor, 5 to 6 homes, only 3 of which are currently occupied, a steam house, and foundational pilings for 4 new homes lines the main avenue. Construction here has focused on water infrastructure. Still under construction is the Maktagavik Evacuation Center, which the community hopes to start using next year. The 2-room building is being built large enough to house 250 people if need be. A little ways further up the hillside is the dining hall that Troy Welch from HC Contractors helped build.
It's going to be a viable community. Very viable. This is going to be a community center, kitchen area. I think it's going to be the heart of the community.
Planners are still working to secure the rest of the funding for the building and much of the planned housing. Though there is much more to be done, there's been a lot of progress. It's been 6 years since Larry Hartig, the commissioner for the State Department of Environmental Conservation, was here. He has been working on relocating Newtok for a decade.
And it was really great to see the rock pit open and the progress on the road. Because I can remember when we just wished we had a rock pit. You know, there has been good progress.
Hartig says the commission's ability to connect state and federal agencies has been crucial. He also pointed out that the 2 wells that have been drilled will be able to use gravity to deliver the water, and that will save on operating costs. The biggest uncertainty threatening continued progress in Maktagavik is what kind of federal funding will be available. In a boat headed back to the old village site, Lynn Palaka, the Bureau of Indian Affairs acting regional director, says Newtok is only one of many villages at risk from climate change. The BIA, he says, is able to help fund roads, but does not have much money available for housing.
Anything tied to transportation, that's what we fund from BIA. And we got limited funding for housing, but, you know, we try to help out where we can.
Newtok resident Albertina Charles is ready to be among the first to move to Maktagavik.
I want to pioneer here in fall time. My daughter is scared for my grandchild. She wanted me to take her with me so she can be safe here. But I want to be safe staying here because last year the water rises more than usual.
With gray skies coming in, Albertina Charles remembers those fall storms. In Newtok, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The State Department of Fish and Game is warning pet owners in the interior and south central Alaska about a recent spike in reports of tularemia, sometimes called rabbit fever. The disease is treatable, but as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it's essential to get an animal to a vet as soon as possible when they're showing symptoms.
State wildlife veterinarian Kimberly Beckman says her office is getting the word out about tularemia after a recent rash of reports of animals sickened by the disease around Fairbanks and Palmer.
Just in the last 2 weeks, there's been a very significant increase in the number of reports. In fact, I had 5 reports in just 2 days earlier this week.
Beckman advises pet owners to keep a close eye on their animals for any sign of the disease because it can kill quickly.
Many people, you know, if the dog's just acting lethargic, maybe has a little fever, they might wait a day or two to go in. But we wanted people to know that this is really an urgent matter to get on antibiotics sooner rather than later.
She cited the example of two household cats in North Pole that died last week, soon after their owner noticed one of them was sick.
The first one died and was diagnosed, and yet in the same household, the second cat became ill and wasn't treated in time, so they lost their other cat.
Bob Gerlach, the state veterinarian, says pet owners should look for symptoms that may not be so easy to detect, especially in younger animals.
Generally, pets can show mild infection that show no symptoms or may show some fever, lack of appetite, lethargy, and just not feeling good.
Beckman says cats and dogs usually contract tularemia by eating the flesh of a sickened animal, usually the snowshoe hare. She says humans, in turn, can come down with the disease through household pets. She says it doesn't happen often. The most recent reported case in the interior was 2 years ago when a North Pole man got sick after skinning an infected hare.
It can be very, very serious.
Beckman says hares, rabbits, and other small mammals come into contact with the bacteria that causes tularemia through ticks that latch onto them. She says the growing number of tick species in this part of the subarctic contributes to the increase in reports of animals contracting the disease. Also, Beckman says there are just lots more snowshoe hares this year because the species is nearing the peak of its population cycle.
There's a very high number of hares, which happens on a 7 to 10 year cycle. So we expect to see a lot more tularemia during a hare high.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Longtime Juneau resident and painter Herb Bonnet died this morning at the age of 87. Bonnet's paintings of boats and planes and iconic local landmarks are all over Juneau, including a large painting on the back wall of the Juneau Assembly Chambers at City Hall. Daughter Michelle Bonnet Hale says her father is very well known by old Juneau.
You can just see his prints all over town, lots of his prints in banks. So he's got a print of the old Douglas Bridge. He's got prints of ferries. One of the more recent prints that he has is called Rainy Night in Juneau, and it's looking up Franklin Street on a rainy night.
Bonnet was the son of an A.J. Mine electrical engineer. He was born at St. Anne's Hospital in 1930 and grew up in Thane and Douglas. He drew and painted for decades. Hale says he died peacefully at the Juneau Pioneer Home. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. You can find all of tonight's stories on our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Abby Collins and Emily Files in Haines, Rasha McChesney and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Christine Trudeau in Newtok, and Laura Craigle on St. George Island. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's program, and I'm Rachel Waldholz. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.